In the not-so-distant past, families new to this country used to encourage their kids to speak English and forget about their mother tongue. That idea is falling out of favor, and new research shows it's more than a cultural benefit to speak two languages. Bilingualism actually does wonders for your brain. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is Ellen Bialystok, Distinguished Research Professor at the Department of Psychology at York University in Toronto. And we're looking forward to hearing from you this morning. Are you bilingual? And if English isn't your mother tongue, are you encouraging your kids to speak two languages? Do they want to speak two languages? And does the brain research make a difference to you, knowing that having this code-switching brain can actually do things like stave off Alzheimer's disease, at least the symptoms of it? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. And Ellen Bialystok, thank you so much for being with us today.
Good morning.
Have you always been a proponent of bilingualism? Were you, I guess another question is, were you expecting the results you found about the benefits in the brain?
Well, we weren't expecting such dramatic results to be found in brain organization and brain structure. I think the attitude towards bilingualism is somewhat different in Canada, where I am from, where I do this work. So I think the expectation might have been somewhat different as well.
So bilingualism in Canada, is it something that's pretty much well accepted and practiced with having the French language spoken as well?
Well, in fact, the main bilingualism in Canada is not between French and English. It's between English or French and some other heritage language. So the main difference, I think, is the way the society encourages families to keep a heritage language in addition to one of the two official languages.
So the government actually takes a position on bilingualism.
Well, I don't want to make it sound too glowing, but we do have an official government policy called multiculturalism, which includes multilingualism. So it is the official position of the government and has been since the days of Pierre Trudeau, maybe our most famous prime minister ever. That doesn't mean that it's all sweetness and light in language world out in Canada, but I think there is a different public attitude on many of these issues than we find here in the United States.
Well, let's talk about some of your research. What did you go looking for?
I was first interested in how children learn a second language. This is going back 30, 35 years. I had done research on first language acquisition and transitioned into what happens in the language system when children and then adults add on another language system. So it was much more of a linguistic and pedagogical question. But I noticed early on in the research that children who were bilingual, who really had another language they used at home, gave very different kinds of responses to the cognitive questions we were using in our research.
And tell us about some of those questions. How did you get at this difference?
We were looking at the time at children's development of what's called metalinguistic awareness. This is the idea that language is not only a means of communicating, you understand what I'm saying because you understand the words I'm using, but it's also a system. It has rules and structure. And the when children are learning language as a meaningful communication, they pay no attention to the structure. Eventually, they learn there's grammar and sounds and rules of combining them. That's an important insight because it's the basis of learning how to read, the basis of using language for logical thinking, the basis of using language for a variety of higher purposes. So we were looking at that. And the finding was not only in our research, there was a lot of research at the time, this is in the late 70s, early 80s, bilingual children were figuring this out significantly earlier than monolingual children.
And you asked a telling question. You asked them, it was a nonsense question, but you asked them whether it made sense. You want to tell us about that all-important question about noses?
Okay, yeah. I think the most famous quote ever attributed to me is the line, apples grow on noses. when people investigate metalinguistic knowledge, the standard procedure is to ask people to tell you if a sentence is grammatically correct or not, because understanding grammatical structure is one of the hallmarks of metalinguistic awareness. So there was a lot of research doing this. Children would be given sentences, and some of them were correct and some of them weren't correct, and they had to make a distinction, and that was evidence for metalinguistic awareness. What we added was a twist to that. So we had sentences that were perfectly grammatically correct but had some ridiculous meaning, apples grow on noses. So we trained children to ignore the meaning and only pay attention to the structure of the sentence. So we wanted a much more difficult test of being able to look through the meaning into the structure. So when we asked children to make judgments about sentences like apples grow on noses, we found that bilingual children could do this. Monolingual children up to the age of 9 were really having trouble with this.
And I gather that the children who are monolingual, who only spoke the one language, heard the sentence, apples grow on noses, and they just kind of said, you asked them, does it make grammatical sense? And they said, oh, that's silly, or they stalled. But in essence, the kids who are bilingual were saying, that makes no sense, but it's grammatically correct, which is a pretty impressive grasp there of grammar at that age.
Very impressive. It turns out to be a very sensitive measure. Now, we've recently done this with adults. Now, we don't ask adults to make judgments about apples growing noses. Obviously, they can do it. But by using a neuroimaging technique that's based on EEG, the electrical waves that your brain puts out, we're able to show that when you ask monolingual or bilingual adults to make judgments about sentences like apples grow on noses and respond only to the grammar, they all give you the right answer. They're adults. They can do it. But the monolingual brains kind of go crazy, and we get big excitations in the monolingual brains because there's a problem. They want to say that there's a problem there. But the bilingual brains show that this is a natural and easy thing to do.
So they're much more efficient, at least in that sort of area of analysis.
That's right. It's an easier problem. And it gets to the heart of what bilinguals do better overall, and that is resolve conflict. So here you have conflict. The grammar is okay. The meaning is not. The task requires you to ignore the meaning. That's a conflict. And that is the paradigm for everything that bilinguals do better.
And putting aside that aspect of it, the good news about bilingualism, there's more of it when you look at what happens in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease, because the people who are bilingual, their brains fare much better at fending the symptoms off, don't they?
Right. So we've had evidence from over 400 patients that on average, bilinguals showed symptoms of Alzheimer's disease later than monolinguals. So that was pretty convincing because it's a large sample and it was a very big time difference. It was in the vicinity of 4 or 5 years. From a public health perspective, that has enormous consequence. If you can have people not functioning in a demented way for 4 or 5 extra years, there's huge public savings involved. But that didn't answer the question of how they did it. So did it mean that they didn't get Alzheimer's disease, or their brains were somehow resistant to the pathology, which is these amyloid beta plaques and tangles? We didn't really know. So we've recently completed an initial study. It's much more small scale, where we had a group of monolingual and bilingual patients who were the same age, all diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and all at exactly the same cognitive level. So any one of these people goes in to see the neurologist, and in all cases, the neurologist sees exactly the same stage of disease progression. So we then look at their brains, And what we found was very dramatic. The overall brain structure, the atrophy that is a normal part of aging, was exactly the same in the two groups. Their brains are changing with aging at the same rate. But when we looked at the part of the brain that tells us how advanced the Alzheimer's disease is, how much amyloid beta plaques have been deposited in the brain, which is the source of all of the dementia and cognitive disruption, the bilinguals had significantly more pathology. They had significantly more advanced Alzheimer's disease in their brains. But they're functioning at the same level as the monolinguals with less disease. So this tells us that bilinguals get Alzheimer's disease. They probably get it at the same time as monolinguals, but they're able to cope with the disease and continue functioning even though the disease is beginning to bend and change and have these very difficult effects on their brains.
So what's going on there? Is it that the bilinguals' brains are more adept at switching back and forth? They have more complicated sort of circuitry so that they can just circumvent the plaque in the brain better?
Well, the answer has to have something to do with compensation. There must be a compensation mechanism in the brain that's built up through this lifelong experience. We have some hints about what it might be, but have not yet been able to demonstrate it. This is a problem we're working on now.
When I first began reading about your research, I thought, hooray, I took some foreign languages. I can speak a few sentences, and I started my son on Spanish this year. But it's not that simple, is it?
No, it's not. When we do the research, we're trying to isolate bilingualism as one factor, one experience that contributes to this large research enterprise called cognitive reserve. So cognitive reserve is the idea that all these things you do to keep your mind active are good for the brain. Crossword puzzles, join a club, take piano lessons, it's all beneficial. So all of these lifestyle choices help preserve your cognitive function. When we do our research, we try to make sure that the only thing that's different between the people in our groups is bilingualism. So this means that there are many, many different ways to get these effects, but we're not studying them. We try to control for them. When we use bilingualism as the factor we're interested in, we're only using it in the sense that the person actively uses two languages all the time and has done so for most of their lives. So that means that people who learned a little bit of Spanish in school but don't use it now, or people who travel to France and sort of brush up their French a bit so they can get better food, they're not really bilingual in our terms. But those sorts of people probably have many other aspects of their life that nonetheless contribute to cognitive reserve. We just try to control for them in our studies.
Well, I was thinking about how, you know, someone like me, I'm Hispanic, but I never learned to speak Spanish. I grew up in this country, you know, I was born here, all of that, and I never took the step to become bilingual. But there are many people here who do have the opportunity and who could speak it in the home. Certainly, you know, over the years in America's history, immigrants were encouraged not to have their children speak that second language. Do you think that has had an effect, public health-wise at least?
Well, I do. And I guess this is the point that I started with. I think these are really broad social issues. And societies kind of fall out on different places. There isn't a right decision or a wrong decision. They're just different decisions. And I think it's true that part of the strength and homogeneity of American society has been this really strong feeling of assimilating into this mainstream culture, which carries the cost of abandoning and perhaps forgetting a heritage language. Other societies make different choices, and so perhaps you get much more multiculturalism, much more multilingualism, but then possibly less nationalism, less homogeneity of purpose in the society. They're just different kinds of social choices, I think. In terms of the research that I do, I think it's quite clear that the personal and possibly social advantage of maintaining the non-official languages at home are enormous.
And I guess in the U.S., the metaphor has been, until recently, the melting pot. And I suppose one of the first things to melt away would have been that heritage language. And now I think we think of ourselves more as, I don't know, a tossed salad. Is that something that you think governments should encourage, the keeping and maintaining of that heritage language?
Well, far be it from me to tell governments what their territory should be. I think from a personal point of view, though, regardless of what governments legislate, I think there should be a personal, individual imperative to maintain your heritage language. Even aside from research on cognition and the brain, if you come to this country from somewhere else where you speak a different language, if you don't pass that language on to your children, your child loses connections with extended family, heritage, culture, family history, aside from whatever other benefits bilingualism per se might bring. So, you know, to me, it's something that families should automatically do.
Would you encourage parents who are monolingual to help their kids become bilingual because of the brain benefits, or is it something that, you know, like you said, we can just give the kids piano lessons and we can do crossword puzzles? Is that just as beneficial, do you think?
Well, I think it might be. And one thing I'm very cautious about is legislating language, not only on a social and a societal government basis, but in a home as well. So I often get questions from parents asking me what I would advise them to speak at home, given their particular configuration. And I don't think you can legislate this. So my advice is always you speak what you're comfortable in. You speak to your children in the language that you're comfortable in communicating with them. And it's usually the language your parents spoke to you. So, you know, it should be about what feels right and what makes the home a warm, safe, communication-friendly environment.
Our guest this hour is Ellen Bialystok. She's a distinguished research professor in the Department of Psychology at York University in Toronto. And we're hoping to take some of your phone calls next and your email. Are you bilingual and have you noticed a difference in how your brain works? Or do you just feel good about having that bilingualism in your life, maybe also in your family? And would you encourage your children to speak two languages? And do you think they want to? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation. Today, Neil Conan explores the changing attitudes about safe sex. This hour, we're talking with Ellen Bialystok, distinguished research professor at the Department of Psychology at York University in Toronto. And we're hoping to take some of your phone calls and your emails. How do you feel about the brain research about bilingualism? Is it enough to convince you that bilingualism is something to strive for, to have your family be bilingual if you have that option? And what do you think about the previous generations that opted just to go English only as they assimilated? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And we'll go to our first phone call now. We have with us Claire in Germantown. Hello, Claire.
Oh, hi. I just have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I understood that every country in the whole world has its language in law, except the United States. Everybody thinks we have English. I took a trip with my husband down the Mexican coast and found out that they're teaching English in the middle school in Mexico. And my question is, I sort of think it'd be nice if we would have English as our national language in law. And Imhoff, he's a Republican from Hawaii, has a bill, Senate Bill 991. He had it in 2 years ago, then he took it out last year. Now it's in the Homeland Security Committee, Lieberman's committee. Senate Bill 991, it says all government action, all government work should be in English. First of all, my question is it true that every country in the whole world does have their national language and law?
I'm not sure if our guests will be able to speak to that. Let's see. Ellen?
I have no idea.
Yeah, we're not really talking about the law, but more the cultural and the psychological perspectives on bilingualism. But thank you for the call, Claire. And we move to Brian in Jefferson. Hi, Brian.
Hi, this is Brian. All right, I'll be with you in a minute, Mom. Well, my grandfather had two languages, and he used to speak Bohemian.
Hmm.
And,
did he pass that along to you?
And I was able to understand him a little bit, you know, and when he come here to visit. And my grandma also spoke that. And I remember they used to speak that, and then I would, you know, they'd ask, they'd say, Yak Shimash, when we came to visit here, and that was, how are you? And then our answer would be, Dobra. And, you know, for the first two sentences, that was, and then the rest of it would be in English. But I was wondering if that was a common trait for, I mean, if that was something that you guys, your guest would be able to comment on.
Okay. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Ellen?
Well, it usually happens that when you have grandparents who speak another language, you pick up a fair bit of conversation that you can understand, even if it's not possible for you to speak that language. So I think that would be quite common, that if your grandparents speak to you in a different language, you learn a bit of it. In order to really make the language your own, though, you'd have to be using it. And I assume that aside from returning the greeting, you didn't really do that.
We we moved to a different state, and so I wasn't privy to a lot of it, you know, or lost a lot of it. But
But it sounds like you can treasure it as a cultural memory and a family memory of your grandfather. Yeah, I have some memories like that too. All right, thank you, Brian, and we'll move to Amanda in Madison. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. I was calling just to say that I'm a bilingual person, and based on the limited knowledge that I have of how neurons work, it makes perfect sense to me that people who are fully bilingual would experience cognitive decline at a slower rate, just because I think when you're fully bilingual, every thought, memory, and little nugget of knowledge that you have is cross-referenced in the other language.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like you have a backup. Even if some of your neural connections were to decline, they're cross-referenced in the other language so that I can see how you'd be able to retain your functioning or some of your memories or some of your working memory for a longer period of time because of that, like, cross-referencing. I know that neurons respond to their neighboring neurons, so there's, I feel like, increased opportunities for them to be fired off from different, different stimuli or whatever.
Uh-huh. What other language do you speak, Amanda?
Spanish.
And how long have you been bilingual?
16 years.
Well, that's a long time. What do you think, Ellen? Does that sound about right, about how this works?
Well, I think that, Amanda, you have some good ideas about how it might work. I think just two quick comments. One is we keep trying to look for evidence that memory is better in bilinguals, but we haven't really found any. So I think your story is very plausible, but it may not be true about memories. But you are right about neurons firing off each other. The main brain difference we have is that the connection, the way neurons are connected to each other, which is the most important thing about thought. It's all about neurons connecting to neurons. So these networks of neuronal connections are different in bilinguals. So these things get wired differently, and the different wiring that comes from using two languages all the time is somehow a more powerful or more efficient way for the brain to wire itself. So I think you're right. It's all in these neuronal connections, and that's why we find a more efficient system in bilinguals.
Well, thank you for the call, Amanda. And let's move to Cole with us from Nina. Hi, Cole.
Hi.
Hi.
Being bilingual helps a lot. I've studied in Poland once for about a month and a half. I've learned a lot there. Excuse me. It's really helpful. Since I was little, like from one, I went every weekend. I went to my grandparents' house, and they would only speak to me in Polish. And then by three or five, I was already speaking fluent, and it's been really helpful.
That's wonderful. And you know, Cole, you're in fifth grade, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds as though, I mean, Cole was saying you picked up the language when you were just still a little kid, and that, I guess, we forget that the children can pick up these languages, a second language, like sponges then.
Mm-hmm.
And do you enjoy speaking Polish?
Yes, it's lots of fun.
And you speak Polish with your grandparents, I bet, still.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's great. I wish I spoke two languages.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Cole, you must continue speaking Polish. It's a wonderful opportunity you have.
Thanks so much, Cole. We appreciate hearing from you today.
Thank you.
And so in terms of young children picking up language two or three, like Cole just said, is that something that, I don't know, we should be aware of and maybe take better advantage of?
Well, you know, everybody knows that it seems at least that children are privileged language learners. They seem to learn languages more easily than adults, and there's some truth to that. But the real important point is that adults are capable of learning more languages. They have to work harder at it. It's more effortful, takes more time, but they can do it. And so adults shouldn't throw their hands up and just believe it's impossible or too hard or too late. You can always learn it. And even if you don't learn another language perfectly to a level of a native speaker, even learning it well enough that you can be functional in it is a great advantage, again, not only because of cognitive and brain payoffs, but because of social and experiential payoffs.
Let's move to our next call. Camille is joining us now. Camille from Frankfort, Michigan. Hello, Camille.
Hi. Thanks for this program. I have two comments that I would like some response on. The first is that my mother grew up in an Italian-American household. Her parents came from Italy, so she grew up speaking Italian and English. And she spoke it well into adulthood, but now she's 87, and because of some chemotherapy and some shingles that went to her brain, she has some level of dementia that prevents her from being able to find all of her words, and when you have to communicate with her, it's really, really tough. But she functions on her own on a level that seems inconsistent with someone with the kind of dementia she has. But with listening to everything you're saying, I'm wondering how much of that ability it is from her having been bilingual most of her life. That's one thing. And the other thing I wanted to say is that as a student of foreign language and linguistics myself, I can understand that for the brain, it's not just learning how to say something in another language. You get a different perspective on the world. It does so much more than just give you other words, other ways to say something. It's a whole picture. It's a whole stretching, I imagine, of your brain functions. So I would just like some, you know, comment on the thing on that and about my mom.
All right, thanks, Camille. Appreciate the call, Ellen.
Okay, so first on the first point about your mother, I mean, I can't make any diagnoses on your mother, but I think that anecdotally, you know, it's an interesting description, and it may well be that because of her experience as a bilingual, she is perhaps better able to cope with the difficulty she's having now. But that is not in any sense a medical diagnosis. I mean, it's just an observation, and you may be right. On the second point, I absolutely agree. We study the brain and cognitive effects of bilingualism, but I always try to remind people about the social and personal benefits as well that are not measurable in terms of brain neurons or cognitive test performance. You are a more worldly, more broadly based and tolerant person if you have access to other languages and other ways of seeing the world.
And it's my understanding that there are other countries that, as you said, in Canada, more actively encourage bilingualism. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm just wondering if, as this research emerges and we look at things like the social benefits and like the health costs that would be possibly quite reduced for Alzheimer's patients alone, if that's something that we'll see more encouragement on in terms of acquiring a second language somehow. Do you see any movement in that direction?
Well, again, as I said earlier, I don't really follow the political dimension of this. It's quite a different field. The problem, though, from a research point of view, is that it's hard enough to compare two individuals. You know, I take two people who were born in Madison, and one is monolingual and the other is bilingual, and I can pretty well make sure that everything else about them is equivalent, and then perform some kind of intervention or assessment and see if the bilingualism makes any difference, because I know everything else is the same. It gets very messy when you compare nations, because nations can be more or less bilingual. I mean, the Netherlands is a very bilingual nation, many Scandinavian nations and so forth. So you have nations that are more or less bilingual, but they are also different in many other ways. They're different in terms of education systems, wealth, socioeconomic status, health, poverty, welfare. I mean, everything else is different. So if you compare at the national level and there's a difference in, say, incidence of Alzheimer's disease, you don't really know which of the many other differences between these nations is responsible. Maybe it's national bilingualism, but maybe it's national healthcare, maybe it's national education, many other possibilities.
Let's take one more phone call. Susanna joins us from Eau Claire. Hi, Susanna.
Hi. I have never been on the air before.
Oh, well, welcome.
Yeah,
thanks. Good to have you here for your first call.
My question is, I have a daughter who's married to a wonderful gentleman that lives in Mexico. They've been married 2 years. He's not up here yet because of immigration difficulties. And they have spoken Spanish and English to the baby since he's been born. And my daughter has taken the baby down there twice, the last time for 3 months, and at that time they spoke completely Spanish to him. And currently, she lives in Madison, she speaks English and she speaks Spanish to him. And I know he understands things because she'll say, "Give Grandma a kiss," and he will. And, you know, he responds to conversation, whether it's English or Spanish. But I was just wondering what the best way or different ways that people teach their babies or young children, well, especially babies is what I'm asking about.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up. Can you repeat this, please? I've lost the, you were breaking up, and I haven't heard from the time you started the question.
I heard her fine. I wonder if there's a problem with your connection, Ellen, but why don't we try again? Go ahead,
please.
Susanna.
Okay. My daughter...
Turn the question on.
Okay, how do you teach babies to be bilingual? What are the different ways? My daughter's married to someone who speaks a different language, Spanish, and she's fluent in Spanish, and she speaks Spanish and English to him, and the dad is in Mexico, and he isn't here because of immigration difficulties.
Okay, thank you very much, Susanna, and thanks for the call.
Okay, here's how you teach children language. You talk to them. That's it. So if you want them to learn Spanish, you speak to them in Spanish. They'll figure it all out. You don't have to do anything special. They will learn the languages in their environment.
So in other words, Susanna's daughter and son-in-law are doing exactly the right thing.
Exactly the right thing. That's exactly the right thing. And when they do move all back here as a family and English is in the environment, this child's English will be absolutely native-like and normal because that's the language that will be her community language. And if you continue to speak Spanish at home, her Spanish will also be fine. Now, it's not good. The languages are not going to be at the same level. And children go through changes in which language is more dominant or more fluent. So a young child who's at home and is speaking Spanish at home in an English community may feel more comfortable in Spanish. But once the child starts school, that can reverse, and English will be dominant and the Spanish will be less proficient, but still good enough. So these will move back and forth. You can't expect both languages to be at exactly the same level.
Our guest this hour is Ellen Bialystok. She's a distinguished research professor in the Department of Psychology at York University in Toronto. And we look forward to hearing from you this morning as we talk about bilingualism and the benefits in the brain. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us, too. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 2 o'clock on Talk of the Nation, NPR's Chris Arnold joins Neil Conan to help sort through the housing conundrum and to look at what housing portends for the overall economy. That's 2 o'clock's Talk of the Nation. We're talking about bilingualism and the benefits in the brain this morning with our guest, Ellen Bialystok. She's a distinguished research professor at the Department of Psychology in York University at Toronto. And we'll go back to our phone lines. Lori's joining us from Menominee Falls. Hi, Lori.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for speaking with me. I'm calling for 2 reasons. First of all, I'm a foreign language teacher, very long duration. I speak 2 languages myself. And my observation is that my students learned better when I started to teach them that the meaning that they were trying to express was as much in the pattern as it was in the words themselves. And actually, the vocabulary is the easier part to learn if you're going to really understand and speak another language. And I'm feeling good about that right now.
Good.
And my question is that currently I'm working very intensely with a school that is a bilingual school. And as all schools in Wisconsin, we take the WKCE. And for the past 3 years, our bilingual classroom children have outperformed our monolingual classroom children by a significant degree. And while we understand that there are many possible contributing factors to that result, my question for you is, could one of the possible factors be that the children's brains, as you have alluded to, are more problem-solving, are able to look beyond just the surface to other ways of decoding meaning in what they are being asked to do?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is entirely possible, but without knowing more about the nature of this bilingual education program and the demographics of the children who are in it compared to those who are in the comparison group, it's impossible for me to say.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your call, Lori. We appreciate it. And we go to Carol in Muscadet. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Dr. Bialystok, I know you've addressed this somewhat already, but my basic question is how much you can generalize, if you wish to at all, and I suspect you don't, about cognition in general and how it works, how we organize, how our brain organizes itself and its networks in learning. For instance, one's deep study of, say, math or chess. Mm-hmm. Some monolinguist is a great chess guy or whatever. Mm-hmm. Presumably reinforces and backs up one network with another. Mm-hmm. What have you learned about the various structures of these networks themselves? I mean, are you going in there with a big flashlight and coming up with any conclusions about the brain in general?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I said earlier that what we see is that the connection of the network connections are different in monolinguals and bilinguals, and I'll tell you more precisely what's different about them. First, if I may, here's a 20-second explanation for why they're different. If you're bilingual, both of your languages are always active, and so you have a problem because you have to produce language from the target system and ignore the other one. That problem is solved by bringing in this brain system called the executive control network. So all of that is background to here's what's different. For bilinguals, the language system and this cognitive system, the executive control system, intermingle. They wire together. So the bilingual system integrates language networks plus cognitive networks into the same system. Just because this cognitive network is needed by bilinguals to speak, it's not needed by monolinguals to speak. So that's the difference. It's an integrated network that incorporates what are normally linguistic and non-linguistic connections into one system, and that's a more powerful system.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for that question, Carol. It's good to get a little more into the technicalities of it. And there's an interesting email here from Bill in Madison who wants to know, is there such a thing as thinking in a language? And does a bilingual person think in the second language? Is that person using more neural resources when dealing in that second language than are associated with that thinking?
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting question. And I'll have to say right at the beginning, I really don't know. I find it interesting. The question of, you know, is thought verbal? Has been around forever, probably. I think most philosophers have their own view on this. I'm not a philosopher. But just the idea that a bilingual might have a different configuration, even entering that domain, sets up all sorts of interesting possibilities, but I don't have a view on it.
Well, let's take another call. We've got Max. Max is with us from Ashland. Hi, Max.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
My comment has to do with I am a bilingual individual in Spanish and English, and I've only known Spanish for the last 7 years or so. But in that time, I've been able to make more connections in my primary language, which is in English, and I can understand English much better in its roots and in the ways in which its grammar is constructed. In thinking about how I've developed my language, I look at friends that I have who speak in sign language, American Sign Language specifically, and I'm wondering how the bilingual research that you've done at this time, how that includes sign language or body language, besides the traditional verbal or written language and linguistics that you're speaking of.
That's a great question.
Thank you. Yeah, very good question. Sign language is very interesting, and we have done one study, and we're almost finished a second study, where we're looking to see if a person who's bilingual in a spoken and signed language shows the same cognitive benefits as the people who are bilingual in two spoken languages. So in advance of a little drum roll here, I'm afraid the answer is probably not. Hmm. And the reason is because, as I said a moment ago, the source of all of these cognitive reorganizational effects is the problem of having two active languages, and you can only say one thing at a time. If I say dog, I cannot at the same time say chien or, you know, some other word for dog. And so that's the speech problem that involves the cognitive system. That is not so with spoken and sign languages. I can say dog and sign dog, so I don't need the additional benefit of this executive control system to make speech fluent. I just do both. It's called code blending, and it's well documented in speech sign literature.
So you're saying sort of the neural benefits are not going to be the same?
Well, so far, all I'll say is that it's early days, but in the 1.5 studies we've done so far, we haven't seen them.
You're in Madison right now, is that right?
Sorry?
You're in Madison right now, aren't you?
Yes.
What are you in town for?
I will be speaking at a meeting here for the Symposium on Research in Child Language Disorders.
Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of research is...
I'm sorry, you've broken up. I can't hear you.
Can you tell us a little bit about what research might be coming down the pike in terms of language acquisition and bilingualism in the brain?
What we're looking at, we're doing two things now in my lab. One is we're looking at, in much more detail, trying to figure out exactly what the differences are at the brain level. So for both children and adult bilinguals, we're using various kinds of neuroimaging techniques to pinpoint more precisely how their cognitive systems are wired differently and possibly how their brains even might look different. So that's one direction. And the second direction we're taking is training studies. So we have a study going on this summer, in fact, where we're going to take 5-year-old kids who are monolingual, and we're going to teach them French over the summer. And we're going to compare how they do before and after this French camp on various kinds of measures. So we want to see these things emerge in real time. We want to see it in a short period of time. And we want to see it in the same kids so we can be sure that the differences we're seeing is because of this training we're giving them.
Oh, that'll be fascinating, and to see how what happens in a short burst of learning French for 5-year-olds.
Right. Yeah.
Do you have any hypotheses about what you're going to see?
Well, I hope so. We've done this before, giving children musical training. Music is another very powerful experience that has, you know, does very good things to your mind. So we've done it before a couple of years ago, giving kids musical training, and we found wonderful benefits after just this very short training. So it's all in towards this goal of understanding how experiences reshape or shape the way the mind is organized.
Let's see, we're getting close to the end of the hour, but we have time for maybe a call or two more. Let's go to Nomi in Hebron, Illinois. Hello, Nomi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I have a comment and a question. My question is, I learned my second language in my late teens, and I became a native speaker. Mm-hmm. And I learned my third language in my late 20s and became a native speaker. Mm-hmm. But I have not spoken those languages for 25 years on a regular basis.
Okay.
Okay. And at the time, it was the only languages, you know, my English became a little bit accented because I wasn't using it at all. And I was just wondering if that would have the same benefit, even though I'm not using them as much now.
Right. How long do you hang on to those benefits if you're not using the language?
Well, yeah, it's tough. We're actually investigating this now because it's an important question. But I'll say this. You know, these effects are cumulative. So it's not a category. You're not a monolingual person or a bilingual person. Everybody has a very kind of mixed, interesting language history. So what we find is, quite simply, the more the better. The longer the better, the more often the better, the more proficient the better. Anything that kind of puts a few more pennies in the pot, it helps.
Well, that's nice to hear. And can you make this kind of improvement? Let's say you're in your 70s, 80s. Do you think if you decide to take an Italian class, is that still going to help? Maybe not in such dramatic fashion as, you know, your original research with Alzheimer's, but is it going to help?
Well, it's going to help, but not because of bilingualism. As I said earlier, this is all part of this idea that everything stimulating you do is good for your brain, and this is crossword puzzles or so on and so on. So taking a language class as a senior is a wonderfully stimulating activity. It's difficult, it's engaging, it requires a lot of your brain to do this. So it's involving your brain in a difficult task that's good for you. So you probably won't end up bilingual, but the whole exercise has great benefit just because it's a mentally stimulating activity.
Now, obviously, you're doing all this research. You get a chance to see the benefits. Are you doing anything to tip your brain in that direction that you're seeing in bilingualism?
Do you, well, me personally?
Yeah, taking a language.
I just work all the time.
Well, too bad there aren't neurological benefits to working all the time. Maybe there are. That's another study. But you do have a couple of bilingual grandkids, don't you?
I do. That's right. And they are fabulously bilingual, and they're a great pleasure to watch.
Well, thank you so much for your time this morning. It's really fascinating research.
Thank you very much.
Ellen Bialystok was our guest this hour, distinguished research professor at the Department of Psychology at York University in Toronto. Thank you to you for listening and for calling in and emailing this hour. We appreciate that. And I would also like to thank Rhonda Fanning for taking your phone calls this morning, and Rhonda and Chrissy Pease both for their production this week. Kathleen Dunn will be back with you next Monday morning, and I'll be with you tomorrow morning for the Veronica Rickert Show. Thanks for listening. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.